I'm Megan McGinnis, and I'm appearing in Daddy Long Legs at the Davenport Theater. You should come see us. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom. Shalom, my friends. Shalom, my enemies. Shalom, everyone. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I love the theater almost more than anything, even almost more than Judaism, Chas v'Chalil. But I love seeing musicals and plays, and I saw a musical a couple of weeks ago that I really, really enjoyed, a very sweet and funny show called Daddy Long Legs, off-Broadway. No, it's not about spiders, which are icky and I hit with a broom, and no, it's not about people who have, well, it is about one person who has very long legs, which makes me jealous since I'm 5'2". But no, I'm talking about this musical based on an old book, and there was a movie, Daddy Long Legs, and it stars this adorable, wonderful singer. Her name is Megan McGinnis, and she is with us on the telephone at the moment. Shalom, Megan.
Yay, hi.
Hi. I didn't even mention you have all these awards for this role. You've got an Ovation Award, you got a Joseph Jefferson Award in Chicago. You're racking them up there.
Well, the biggest award is actually being able to do this show in New York City. I'm so happy to be home.
Well, what people might not know is that you first premiered, and the musical first premiered, back in 2009. You were a little sprigget of a thing back then, and you won an award for that. It was where, at what theater? The Rubicon?
Was it? The Rubicon Theater in Ventura, California.
Wow. It caught on immediately, and then you got a nice award from them. Did you think that 6 years later you would be doing it in New York? Or maybe did you think 1 year later you would be doing it in New York?
Yeah, I still remember when one of our producers came to me in January of 2010 and said, "So, I think we're planning for a 2013 opening in New York." And I was crushed. I just thought, oh, that's so far away. And then we're in 2015.
Well, you have been touring it in different places. You've been to London. How many other places have you been?
14 other theaters.
Gewalt. What was the reasoning? Was it, thinking back then, if it had flopped in New York, you couldn't bring it anywhere else. But if you bring it everywhere else, then you bring it to, what was the thinking?
Well, there were a couple of things. Our producer described it to me as a grassroots campaign, sort of like a political campaign, which I thought was very interesting. You sort of get everybody into the show and wanting it, and then they realize, oh, it's in New York, and support it. That was one reasoning. But the other was that we weren't necessarily sure New York was where it was headed. I think we all just wanted to make the best products, the best show we could. We changed the show in every city, so in every theater it was different.
What's an example of a big change from, say, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago of Daddy Long Legs? A plot change, a character change, what?
One of our biggest changes happened our second year. We took 3 days as sort of a workshop when we were in Arizona, and we redid the end of the second act.
Oh.
We felt like everything stayed the same. The plot has always been the same. The plot is very much based on a book. We did not stray from that. It was just about how to emotionally fulfill the audience at the end. I don't know if you remember the song, "I've Torn You From My Heart," but it's a song that I sing near the end about being very brokenhearted about Daddy Long Legs not showing up at my graduation. It used to come later, and it almost felt that it wasn't deserved there. So we really had to find a place where "I've Torn You From My Heart" worked. It was our favorite song in the show, but it can't stay just because you love the song. It has to be deserved. So we sort of changed the order of things and had Jervis sing part of "Charity" underneath the end of "I've Torn You From My Heart" to sort of tie it all in. And it, all of a sudden, we realized, oh, there's the end of the show. We got it.
Well, we should mention, I guess I was remiss, that people don't know the plot. It's all about this very, very rich guy who anonymously puts this orphan girl through college, and then he supports her, and his only request is that she mail him, this is back in the days of snail mail, posting him a letter once a month to tell him how she's doing. But otherwise, he doesn't want any part of it, he doesn't want to know, he's just a benefactor, a rich, anonymous benefactor, except he ends up getting a lot more involved, kind of weirdly, anonymously, and not so much.
Yes, he starts reading her letters and is very taken with her. She, of course, thinks that he's old, because who has money but old people?
Yeah. I certainly don't.
he reads her letters, is taken with her wit and her charm, and decides that he wants to go meet her. And he actually is also her roommate's uncle. So he goes to meet her as her roommate's uncle. And, of course, they fall in love. But she is still writing him these letters. But, of course, she writes the letters to Daddy Longlegs, not realizing they're also going to Jervis Pendleton, who she's falling in love with. So it becomes very complicated and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine the first couple of years of getting this play developed, the musical developed, was really just kind of working on the creepiness factor.
Yeah, you know, I don't read reviews. I never have for this show. But, of course, the creative team does, just so they can learn about people's opinions. And certainly, reviewers mentioned that early on. And, of course, the movie version of Daddy Longlegs, which is so not related to the book and not related to our musical, had a very, very large age difference between Fred Astaire and Leslie Caron, who played the two leads. That is not what is going on with us. The age difference is about 5 years. But, you know, when you are addressing letters to your daddy and you are falling in love with that person, yes, you have to address that issue.
And it's not even just the age. Even if he is young, there is a weird stalkery kind of thing going on, which you
have to finish that. Some people have mentioned the idea of him manipulating her, but, you know, I think we actually really delve into that in the show, of how torn he is, how in love with her he is, and he just doesn't know what to do about it.
I mean, it's a tough line that I think the musical walks pretty well. I did not see Gigi a season ago on Broadway, but they had the same issue to deal with. And I think from the reviews from that said that they dealt with it by really sanitizing it and making it very G-rated and walking the other side of the line. So I don't know. And but you must still be loving and enjoying this. I hope so. It's been 7 years.
I do. I love it so much. I can't believe how much fun I still have every night. I think a lot of that has to do with the audience because, as you know, since you've seen the show, I pretty much talk to the audience the whole night. And just having that energy every night from them and how different it is with a different group of people, I think that really keeps me going. Also, Jerusha's story, the way that she grows over these 4 years, it's such a great journey. I love doing it.
Now, people who look at pictures of Megan McGinnis or hear her sing, they'll think, oh, this cute little young girl, she's probably 19, she hasn't done anything, she's never been on Broadway. Nah-ah. You were on Broadway all the way back, was Beauty and the Beast the first one? You were a replacement Belle, as it were?
I was a replacement Belle. I think that was in 2003, but no, my first Broadway show was in 1998. I was in the original cast of Parade at Lincoln Center. No, that was my second Broadway show.
Oh, wait. So wait, what was...
The Diary of Anne Frank was my first Broadway show, which was in the spring of 1998.
You know who you should... You need to contact the Internet Broadway Database people, because they're not listed there. It's in your bio, but...
Well, Anne Frank is... It's very interesting. I think I have to send them proof, because I was a vacation replacement.
Oh.
So I was only in the show for 1 month. I was an insert in the playbill, and I think the Internet Broadway database is based on what's printed in the playbill.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I know. I talked to them years ago, and they were like, oh, yeah, just send us proof. And I was like, oh, yeah, I should do that. And I never did.
Well, did you get to act opposite Natalie Portman, who was playing Anne Frank?
I did not. I never went on. I was a vacation.
Oh!
I know. I was an understudy. I understudied Margot, who was played by Rachel Miner. And I learned the show, rehearsed the show, and never went on. It was still...
Oh, so maybe that you don't belong on the IMDb because you never did... you weren't on there. You know, I could say I understudied too. Yeah, I never went on the stage. They should put my name in there.
I still did the work. I still did the run-through on the Broadway stage.
I understudied Anthony Hopkins and Equus, let me tell you. Oh, my God. For 4 years I did that. Never went on. He was a very healthy man.
Now I'm going to need to get proof just to prove to you.
Alfred Lunt, when he was sick one day, and Lynn Fontanne came to me and said, can you go on? I said, yeah. And then last minute, he bounds on stage. I don't get my credit. Son of a bitch.
You would have been brilliant.
I would. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, you did you at least get to go on when you did the Sideshow revival?
Yes. Yes, I went on for about a week of performances. Yeah, as Violet.
Oh, so you were one of the twins.
Yes, yeah.
What the hell was that like? Like, being stuck together for two acts?
It was actually amazing. It was very scary because as an understudy, of course, you don't have a ton of rehearsal. And Erin Davey, who played Violet, was sick, and so I went on with Emily Padgett, who plays Daisy, and, you know, I felt bad for Emily because she has a whole new girl stuck to the side of her. And she was.
I wouldn't mind that. Anywho. My wife isn't listening. It's fine. Yes.
Oh, good. She was the most supportive and wonderful, and it actually felt much safer being stuck to someone because I knew where to go.
Now, did you, you had just gone on now, I mean, you had rehearsed and stuff. Were there any mistakes that you made? Were you perfect? Were you clean? Or were you just kind of trying to fill her shoes or trying to create your own character? How does that work?
I think as an understudy, you take what you see in front of you, and you try and give everyone else on stage what they're used to, because that is your job, to not shake up the show too much. But, of course, I'm doing it through me, so I am bringing myself into it, but I don't try and ever bring about a whole new character or anything like that. Try to be very faithful to what Erin was doing. But it's really, I think it's such a great job. It's terrifying, but I love learning through watching other people, so it's kind of perfect.
Cool. Now, here are other shows that you were in on Broadway. Two of them involved this horrible, terrible lady named Sutton Foster. Do you know her at all?
Yes. She is one of my best friends.
Okay, and were you friends before you worked together in the first show? Was it Little Women or Millie?
No, we met during Millie.
Okay.
Which was, 2003, 2004, one of those years. I joined the cast about 2 months after they won the Tony, so I was not in the original cast. So I met her then, but we didn't hang out a lot. Her part was very, very difficult. I did not see her a ton backstage. But at the time, I was already doing workshops and readings of Little Women. And when she got a phone call about maybe participating in the pre-Broadway tryout, she came and talked to me and asked me what I thought of the show, and I said, you need to do it. It would be so amazing. We should do this together. And then a year later, we were at Duke University doing our pre-Broadway tryout, and we became so close and so wonderful. And we did Little Women for not too long. I guess it ran for about 6 months. And ever since then, we've also been, you know, she tours a lot with her concert, and we sing a duet called Flight that we've been doing at different cabarets, and now we do it with the symphony, too.
Whoa.
It's incredible.
Mit Mazel. Were you at her wedding? I think she got married a year or two ago.
One year ago. Yes, of course. And she was my maid of honor at my wedding.
Oh, now you, by the way, are married to an actor, Oy Gavald.
Yes.
Adam Halpin. Is he Jewish?
No.
Ah, damn.
I am.
What? Sorry?
I'm half Jewish.
You are half Jewish?
Yes, I am.
What half? Top or bottom? No, wait. But who's Jewish on your side?
My father.
Oh, so you're almost. It's not the half that really is. So what do you celebrate?
Growing up, we would celebrate Passover and Hanukkah.
Now,
you know, the important ones, right?
Yeah. Well, Yom Kippur also, but then... And Yom Ha'atzma'ut. Don't leave that thing out. A big one.
Okay. I'll ask my dad about that.
Yeah, Yom Ha'atzma'ut. Oh,
all right.
Deck, all right. Everything with oranges. So now, though, with a Goyish husband, you do Christmas?
Oh, yes. We also celebrated Christmas growing up as well. My parents just wanted me to experience everything, and... I don't really do Passover and Hanukkah as much anymore. Sometimes I'm invited to Seder's and I'm happy to go, but yeah, I know.
Well, not to be too nosy, but are you and your actor husband planning for little ones? Little McGinnai or Halpi?
And that's not nosy at all. Of course it's nosy.
Of course it's nosy, but, you know, if you raise the children...
What would we do?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I'd want to... raised our kids as I was raised, which is have them decide themselves.
All right. Not Muslim, though. Anything but Muslim, I'll be all right. And the Moonies. Stay away from them. Not
okay.
The other religions are right, perhaps.
Okay.
Festivus, you can do that. So, we're talking with Megan McGinnis, the half-Jewish Megan McGinnis, yay. You were in Thoroughly Modern Millie, which was a big hit, almost kind of like a sleeper hit. And it went on to win the Tony, I believe.
For Best Musical and Best Actress.
Yeah, for your friend Sutton Foster.
Yep.
You were also in, as you said, The Little Women, which wasn't such a hit. As you said, it ran about a half a year. Do you have a different sense that even if you don't read reviews, can you sort of tell before opening night what's going to happen? Or you really don't have any idea, and then you get a sense the first week after opening of whether you're going to be a hit or flopper in the middle?
No, it's so hard because it's such a business. You know, it's so artistically fulfilling, and yet there's this whole other business side. And sometimes I really choose to play ignorant, you know?
Well, I don't have to choose to play that. I basically am ignorant. It's easy for me.
I think it is very hard to tell before opening because you almost get your most supportive crowds and supportive word of mouth before opening. So everything seems like it could be a hit then. And then depending on when you open, you can't really judge the crowds afterwards because, you know, there are different months of the year where attendance just goes way down. So for Little Women, we opened in January. January and February are
terrible months to do anything, yeah.
So, you know, I think so much of a show's success depends on so many factors that just have nothing to do with you or your show creatively. So I just try not to think about it and just be really happy with my work. I know that sounds so...
No, that's what you pretty much have to do. I get horrible letters about my sermons all the time, but I keep doing them. I just go out there, I curse and scream, I try and tap a rock and turn it into water, it doesn't happen. So, I just try again next time. But speaking, your husband, Adam Halpin, an actor, now he went through a literal one-night flop.
Did you
have to help him? I mean, what was that like for him, and how were you able to... Because he must have been pretty depressed for a week or two.
Well, I'm going to tell you, this is going to be not great news, but I did not know him then.
Oh.
So I met him. We started dating in the fall of 2008, and Glory Days was in the spring of 2008. And I actually saw the dress rehearsal of Glory Days with... someone else that I was dating at the time.
Okay.
And I met Adam after the show, and he was really wonderful on the show. Then, of course, heard about it. I mean, who didn't hear about it?
Right.
But, you know, I have to say, with a show, I say this to him still, in some ways, it's even better that it happens like that, because you do live on in infamy. You know, people hear about it, and I think that makes them seek out the show and the music, and they learn about what wonderful things were there. You know, the score's so fantastic, and then people buy the album, and so in the end, maybe it's better than having a half-hearted run.
It's a little better known than the show that ekes out a 4 or 5 month run.
Yeah, who knows? You know, I could see both sides, but that's certainly what I tell him.
What is he doing these days? Is he doing theater or
yeah,
what?
He was just on the national tour of Kinky Boots.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he was on it for about 7 months. And when I started Daddy Long Legs, we decided he should probably come home because of my schedule. We have a very odd schedule. We have Wednesdays off.
Ah, weird.
So it's just a smarter way of selling tickets on nights that people don't have other options. You know, for an off-Broadway show, you just want to keep trying to find your audience.
Oh, there should be more Thursday matinees. I've always said this. There should be Tuesday matinee. I'm not joking. Or there should be curtains at maybe 5 or 6 o'clock, for not just on Sundays. I think there's a whole niche market out there for people who can go at different times.
Anyway. Yeah, I think our producer's really trying to pursue that. So we have... 2:30 and an 8 on Saturday, a 3 and a 7:30 on Sunday, a Monday at 8, a Tuesday at 7, and then Wednesday's off, and then Thursday, Friday, of course.
So you both have Wednesdays off. That's your day. That's your day to lie around and read the New York Times, basically.
Yes, or call you, because that's what I'm doing today.
So, what about, and you, have done really mostly theaters since this millennium. Back in the late 90s, you have a lot of IMDb credits on different things and TV shows and a couple of little movies, but is that a conscious choice to really concentrate on theater and musical theater and not be out in L.A. for pilot season?
Well, I think a part of it is I grew up in Los Angeles, so all that television stuff came about because I was there, living there, growing up. And when I decided to go to college back east, one of the reasons I decided to go to college back east is because I wanted to do Broadway. That was that was always my dream. It became pretty clear to me when I think I was 13, and I was doing a community theater production of a musical version of A Christmas Carol, and I booked an episode of Blossom, and I had to miss a show, and I was devastated.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, well, I guess I really love musicals and theater. So I decided to really only apply to colleges in the New York area.
And what's interesting is that instead of going to like the Circle and the Square Theater School or NYU, you did go to Columbia, but you didn't go for theater and music and plays. You went for an English degree, no?
Yeah, I majored in English.
Was that your parents telling you have a fallback or what? Why?
Yeah, a little bit, yes. My parents are so supportive, they said I should do whatever I wanted. But they strongly advised that I consider majoring in something else in case I changed my mind. I was 17 when I moved to New York, and, you know, they just said, are you sure? And I said, no, I'm not sure. So I think that's a great idea. I will major in something else. And, of course, I tricked them because I knew if I went to a conservatory school or did a musical theater program like at NYU, you're in classes from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day, right? At Columbia, I could take all my classes, be done by 3 p.m., and still go to auditions.
Oh, and actually, I think in places like NYU and other acting schools, they don't even let you audition. You're not allowed to for two or three, you know, even until like senior year. You're forced to act in only their stuff because they're molding you.
Yes, I absolutely understand that. It was just not what I wanted. So I thought, great, I'll get my major in something else, and I'll start auditioning. And I got my first two Broadway shows while I was still in school. Thank you.
Was that Christmas Carol the first thing you ever appeared, the first show you ever appeared in, or what was the first?
Oh, no, the first show I ever did was a production of The King and I when I was 5 years old.
And you were Lonta, or no?
I was one of the king's children. Yes, with 2 hours of makeup.
All right. Okay. But so and. Was that a wonderful experience? Was it what you expected, and or was it something, you know, because some people have terrible experiences and still stay with it, or was it great?
I loved it for the first couple of weeks, and then I hated it and told my mom I wanted to quit. And she said, okay, you can quit when we're done, because we made a promise. We're going to see this out, and then you never have to act again. But then by the time you closed, I was in love. So I just wanted to keep doing it.
Oh, McMazel. And let me ask you, because you are doing mostly theater, and you tour a whole heck of a lot, you make an okay living. You're able to survive on what you and he make, living in New York, right?
Yes.
No, I'm saying that's not the easiest thing to do. That's why people flock to California, because they want to make the big score if they can. But
true.
You guys are okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've luckily worked consistently, so that's been, we're lucky, very lucky.
And also you've got this show, Daddy Long Legs, that for all the other shows that you've been doing throughout, that's always come back for you, and it's still obviously here, could be here for a few years off-Broadway, because it's a really nice show and people are liking it. But
I certainly hope so.
Are you still look like a 21-year-old. Are you afraid when you hit a certain age that it's like, oi, boy, you know, you can't be Cicely Tyson doing Daddy Long Legs? That would be very, very weird.
Well, don't worry. I won't want to do Daddy Long Legs that long.
You never know.
It is a very difficult show, so I don't know how many years I can give it. But, of course, I probably said that 6 years ago, and here I am still doing it.
There you go. Exactly. But do you fear that thing of turning into, you know, hitting that age when you're not ingenue anymore, but
yeah, you know, I think, absolutely. absolutely. I think every woman considers that in show business. I think it's much harder in the television and movie world than in the theater world. I think the transition is a little bit easier in theater, and I have so many wonderful female friends who've made that transition and people I can look up to and think, oh, it is possible. And I have been lucky that some of my roles in between all my Daddy Long Legs stints have been more adult. Even Sideshow, for instance, they were definitely more adults. So, of course, I worry about it, but I just hope the roles come along. That's all I can hope for.
I mean, you have another 15, 20 years before you really have to worry about it. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Can I ask you, Megan McGinnis, what is your favorite all-time theater song, either to sing or just to hear?
Ooh, that's a hard question. I think, can I actually change the question? Can I tell you what album I like to listen to?
No!
Because...
No, you may not. Of course, okay, go ahead. What album? Is it Company?
No, it is... Oh, there are two albums that I can listen to from the beginning to the end. One is Ragtime and Violet.
Ragtime and Violet,
Violet. Violet by Janine Tesori.
Yeah. Sutton Foster was just singing on Broadway 2 years ago, yeah.
She was! Those two scores are just so beautiful, and they tell the story so well. I just think it's very rare to be able to listen to an album from the beginning to the end. Now, I say that not having listened to a lot of albums recently, so I've heard, of course, the same thing about Hamilton, for instance, and which I have not seen or listened to, and I cannot wait. Have you seen it?
No. They're not letting me in until 2031. So if I'm still alive, they'll wheel me from the nursing home. And at that point, Cicely Tyson will be in it. She'll have a small role there.
We should buy our tickets now, right?
Wait, I think we'll have to, as a matter of fact. And by the way, people should buy their tickets now for a little show called Daddy Long Legs, which is playing at the Davenport Theater off-Broadway. It's right in Midtown, easily accessible, nice little theater. It used to be called the 45th Street Theater, I think. And then they renamed it for the producer, Ken Davenport. So, who has obviously been very supportive. Do you remember when you were auditioning first for that role of Jerusha? Did you remember what you auditioned with and how you found you got it?
Yes, I remember very well because I had actually seen a reading. I should go back a little bit further. I know Paul Gordon, our composer and lyricist. I've known him socially through mutual friends. And he lived in Los Angeles for a very long time. And I went out to visit my parents. And we ended up having lunch. And he said, I had auditioned for Jane Eyre, which had been on Broadway already, which he wrote with John Caird. So he knew me from that as well. And he said, I think you'd really like the show. And he gave me a demo recording of Daddy Longlegs. Not with the intention of you'd be a good Jerusha, just... if you like Jane Eyre, you'll like this.
Right.
And I remember putting it into my CD player in my car and listening to it all the way home and being so taken with it. A couple years later, I heard they were doing a reading of it. I went to go see it. At this point, John and I had already worked together on the revival of Les Mis. And I just fell in love with the piece. And I said to them, if you ever have auditions, please just let me sing these songs just once. That's all I want. So I found out they were having auditions a couple months later and got an audition. The audition packet was about 70 pages.
Gaval.
Had, six songs in it and a bunch of her letters. And, you know, usually as an actor, when you get such a large audition packet, you roll your eyes and just think, oh, I have to learn all this stuff, and then I'm going to go in and they're going to ask me to do one song and one scene and all this work for nothing. But I just wanted to work on the material. It excited me. So I spent about a week learning it, and I missed the initial audition because I was out of town, so I went straight to the callbacks. And
you were allowed to do that?
What?
How were you allowed to go straight to the call? They let you?
They do that sometimes for actors who can't make first audition.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really just scheduling and, you know, if they have room. In fact, I was out of town because I was visiting Adam because he was on a different tour at the time.
Oh, okay.
So I walked in the room, and they had me pick one song. I picked my favorite song, which was I Couldn't Know Someone Less at the time. Now, all of them are my favorites. And they had me pick one scene, which I picked the monologue where she talks about missing him. And then they were like, okay, thank you. And I think that was really all I did. And I left, and I thought, I just wish I could have had a little bit more vibrato on that one note.
Right.
One note that was really bugging me. And I texted Paul Gordon later that night, and I said something about that one note. And he called me, and he said, you got the job. And I just couldn't believe it. I was so excited. And I didn't hear from my agent for 3 days, so I kept thinking he was wrong. I didn't really get it. It was all a joke. I can't even remember why we didn't talk about it, but...
Well, here's the interesting thing. I mean, you knew Paul Gordon well enough to be texting him. You appeared in you know, you had some sort of friendship with him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been weird had you not gotten the job? I mean, how do you
look... Oh.
You know, if you felt you were really, really right for it, obviously. Not if you were in the wrongish role. But is it tough being in an acting community and knowing playwrights and composers and lyricists and figuring, hey, you know, I could have been right for this. And they know me. Why didn't they hire me?
It is difficult. I think it's not difficult when you're talking about someone like Paul Gordon because he's so loving and so lovely. He just has a way of making everybody feel welcome and appreciated. So I know that if I had not gotten the job, he still would have picked up the phone. He still would have called me and he would have said, look, you were wonderful, but
right.
We went with so-and-so because of XYZ. I think the best way to deal with it is being honest. You know, I mean, so much of auditioning is not about your talent. It's about if you're the right fit. Almost everyone who walks in the room is talented, is good enough to play the role.
True.
So to hear from your friends that you were wonderful, but... ...
Yeah.
That's sort of nice. It is a little scary going into a room full of friends, I won't lie. Like, that's almost harder than going into a room full of strangers.
Hmm.
But ultimately, I think it does lead to a more supportive environment.
Did they ever tell you why they chose you as opposed to the butt thing? And I do have a rather large butt. But no, as opposed to saying, well, we would have gone with you, but did they ever tell you for this role, we went with you because?
The team just said I walked in and I was Jerusha. So I don't know more specifically than that. I think it was just the right meeting of character and person.
Well, if people want to see the results of that, because I completely agree, if you go to that theater and you go to the Davenport Theater and see Daddy Longlegs, we'll see that Megan McGinnis is Jerusha. It's a wonderful role. I'm not going to guarantee, but I'll bet you'll get a few, at the very least, nominations towards the end of this season. It won't be Tony's because it's off-Broadway, but other things like the Nobel, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Might be up for that.
Excellent.
It's a marvelous performance, and it's been an absolute delight talking to Megan McGinnis. You can go to her website to find out a bit more about her bio and the other things she's done. Your website kind of needs some updating there.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't advertise the website because it wasn't updated, hasn't been updated in about the time I've been doing Daddy Longlegs, 6 years.
It's kind of funny. Your most recent bit of news was, hey, I'm doing the debut of Daddy Longlegs at the Rubicon Theater in Los Angeles. So,
I've got to find someone to update it. I have no knowledge of websites. I'm much better on Twitter, so if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's Menguin McGee. How about that?
Menguin or Megan?
Menguin. It's like penguin, but with an M.
Oh, how cute!
Menguin McGee.
And you have a Facebook, too, I guess.
Yeah, but I usually don't. I'm not a Facebook person. I really try to keep it to Twitter and, you know...
So,
140 characters, right? It's easier.
So check out Menguin McGee, or the at symbol, the Menguin. So have I been semi-mispronouncing? Is it Megan or Megan?
No, it's Megan. You got it right.
It is Megan. I got something right. Yay!
Yay!
So last question for the delightful Megan McGinnis. What, apart from, obviously, Daddy Longlegs, what's on your forecast as far as what you're going to be doing work-wise, life-wise?
Daddy Longlegs has been in my forecast for so long. I just kept saying to myself, I just just want Daddy Long Legs in New York. Just want Daddy Long Legs in New York. And now we're here, and we just opened, you know, 3 weeks ago. I haven't had time to think about what's next. I guess that's...
Oh, you know, some people, even when they're injured, they'll do a cabaret evening, that sort of thing, also.
Yeah, you know, this show is so, so hard. I'm not sure I'd have it in me to do a whole night of my own stuff. We'll see. I'm singing at some symphony concerts with Sutton next year. I think we're singing at the Baltimore Symphony in February.
Ooh.
And the Des Moines Symphony in April.
Des Moines! Wow! Des Moines.
Yeah, so that'll be really fun. And we'll see what comes next. I'm really excited to see what happens.
Well, we are all excited to see what happens in the life and the career and the music of Megan... Now I was telling you right before. Menguin McGinnis.
Such a pleasure talking to you.
You too. Thank you so much, and shalom to you.
Shalom.